It is Saturday, January 12th, 2008, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, the Week in Geek News. And this week, that means the 2008 Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today we are covering the Week in Geek News, and joining us is Peter Sheeran, who spent the week at CES, the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. During the second half of the show, I welcome you to join our conversation. You can ask us anything you like. The numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877, or you can go to geekspeak.org right now to send us email. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the Arum with me are geeks John Tracy, technical support at Acceleron. Hi.
Acceleron.
I'm so sorry. John, good morning.
Good morning.
It's been a while. I'm glad to have you here. Thank you very much for coming in. Do you have some space news for us?
Always.
Good, good. We'll do it in a second. And Sean Cleveland, senior technical marketing manager at NVIDIA. Morning, Sean.
Morning.
Thanks for driving us in this morning. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
And we also have Peter Sheeran. Now, Peter, I don't actually know your title, but you were just at CES, and you're a radio aficionado and just a geek in general, would you say?
Yeah. Ham radio geek, K6WEB.
All right.
So I have a call sign too, and used to work with Sean for a bit.
At NVIDIA?
Yeah, and left there last week and on my own now.
And so you leave there and for fun you go to CES.
Yes.
Most people have to work CES. So,
well,
so let's go ahead and start. What was one of the most exciting things about CES? You know, let me give some context
about
what CES.
What is CES, Lyle?
So CES is the Consumer Electronics Association.
It's put on by the Consumer Electronics Association.
Thank you. And it's called the Consumer Electronics Show, and it's probably the largest electronics consumer in the United States show. It's in Vegas. And see, so 130,000 people attended this year, I believe. And
yeah, it's not bad.
It's a big show.
It's like the size of a city, inside a city.
The initial attendance estimate actually is down to from 143,000 of last year. So
oh,
it's a
really?
Little smaller.
I bet you because of, you know, gas prices and travel. And,
sure.
You know,
yeah.
That
and the cabbies sense. Noticed it too.
Yeah, I bet.
Now, Peter, you were saying that you covered,
but let's talk about the size.
Well, yeah, you covered most of the show, but in reality there's like 185 million square feet.
I missed a few of it.
You missed a few square
so
feet.
So what is that as big as? As large as a what?
36 football fields.
Wow.
It's a big show. Now,
yeah.
Is that all in one building, Peter? Or is there
oh, God, no. It takes over all of the Las Vegas Convention Center, which is North Hall 1 and 2, Central Hall 1 and 2, South Hall 1, 2, 3, and 4, the parking lot across the street. Actually, two parking lots across the street. There was a BMW F1 race car that you could sign up to drive. home networking, home automation house set up in a couple mobile double-wide trailers across the street. Plus, probably a bunch of private meeting rooms in the Hilton and the Sands Convention Center.
Oh, really? Over the Sands?
Over at the Sands. And attached to the Sands Hotel is gone, but the hotel that's there now is the Venetian.
Yeah, the Venetian.
And all the meeting rooms in the Venetian plus three floors of suites.
How do you find everything?
Six maps. 6 18 by 24 inch fold-up maps.
So were there a lot of people standing around with these giant maps, like, looking?
I was. I didn't notice if anyone else was.
What's amazing is this is 130-something thousand industry professionals.
Yeah, that's right.
They don't let the public in.
Yeah. That's a big industry.
Yeah, it's sizable.
2,700 companies were there, And they released estimated 20,000 new products this week. So we have a few things to talk about.
We're going to talk about them all.
We're going to cover 80%, actually. So
at one product per second.
I actually needed another day and a half, I think, to see the rest of the show.
Yeah, you didn't catch all of it. All right, so what stuck out in your mind? You get to pick the first thing.
Displays. There's a lot of cool stuff going on with displays.
150-inch plasma?
Yeah, but you know...
You saw it?
A dollar an inch. Think about that.
Ouch.
that's the rough ballpark. Uh-huh. Maybe a little less than a buck, but...
Well, there are some super thin displays, correct?
There were. I actually didn't see those. What I saw were some things that were more interesting. Lots of people were doing stereoscopic displays.
Ah.
There's some cool tricks you can do with DLP displays because the mirrors can move so fast you can actually get 120 hertz per eye.
Wow.
Sorry, 120 hertz total.
60 hertz per eye.
60 hertz per eye. And with liquid crystal shutter glasses that block the left eye, then the right eye, then the left eye, you can show... discrete images. Hang on. Let me find the mute button.
We use a web-based chat client called Meebo, and every once in a while it pops up an ad, so that's what's going on in the background.
A flash ad with audio, yeah. I better mute mine before it starts. Okay. So you're saying it's a 3D display, and the mirrors in the DLP, which actually produce the light that throw
Correct.
It out, that decide which color it's going to go to, can also decide where the light goes to, your left eye or your right eye. Or more accurately, it throws out an image for your left eye and then an image for your right eye.
Right.
And if you're wearing glasses that will then close your left eye and right eye fast, you just see the information. You see different information for both eyes.
Correct. And it's pretty – it's mostly complete. It's getting maybe 95% of the light blocked on each eye.
Which is probably enough if it's bright, right?
It's enough for a good stereo effect, but it's not perfect. So you'll see some ghosting of the right eye image and the left eye image and vice versa.
And if you stare at it long enough, you fall over?
Some people get nauseous, some people get headaches, and it also depends on how you're creating the stereo effect. If you're trying to make stuff jump out of the screen,
yeah,
you want to do that sparingly because you will give people headaches. And everyone has different sensitivity.
Sure.
And I tend to notice things that other people can't see, like I'm more sensitive to the ghosting and the refresh rate.
Mm-hmm.
But what was really cool was you were seeing this technology all over the show floor, but in the TI booth where they were touting DLP, they were doing two things. They were doing stereo, and in a separate room, they were doing what they called dual view. So instead of doing stereo images for one person, they're doing full screen images for two people.
Oh,
so if you've got a driving game, and you've got two people each in their own car on a different part of the racetrack, they put on the shutter glasses, and eyes get the same image. So the person on the left gets the left eye image, the person on the right gets the right eye image, and they see full screen mono.
Yeah.
Image.
I see this as a perfect solution to couples that want to watch different televisions, right?
So that was about the second thing that occurred to me, and it was not part of their marketing message.
It really wasn't. Yeah.
It blew my mind.
So you can sit next to each other and watch two different shows on the same screen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, then you have to wear headphones, so you get different audio.
Right,
but
So how did it look?
It looked amazing. Every time I've seen the liquid crystal shutter stereo, I've found problems. There are some inherent problems in it. It's a good effect for many people, but it's not perfect. I couldn't find the image bleeding on the dual view setup.
Oh, so the image bleeding that you don't like wasn't showing up on this one at all? Oh, so it was good.
And there's a possibility it was related to the particular images from the driving simulator.
Or that you were really tired.
Possibly, but I'm betting that there's something else going on with
How long could you watch something like that?
You know, it depends on the person.
Yeah.
Well, how about you? Did you feel like it was going to
be? Could you do 2 hours? Could you watch a 2-hour movie?
Perhaps. The stereo stuff, not with that technology. I think I'd get annoyed. I get annoyed after 5 minutes.
Talking about the two screen view.
Yeah, but the two screen view, probably for a whole movie.
Really?
But some people get headaches after 5 minutes.
And depending on how comfortable the glasses are.
Yeah. There's a lot of psycho stuff going on with how the eyes work and how the brain...
Sure. All right. Well, thank you, Peter. Let's go to the next news story. John, you got some space news for us, correct?
Yes.
Go for it.
Every planet that begins with an M. Mars has an asteroid that we thought was going to hit it, and it was very exciting because we get to do a lot of cool science when an asteroid impacts Mars.
I recall Jupiter getting hit a few years ago with a large asteroid.
Yeah, with the Chevy.
Chevy-sized asteroid.
Yeah, the Levy-Shoemaker comet.
And that was hit by a comet. That's right. A little larger.
Right, yeah.
They're a little different kind of device.
But this would have still left a nice crater about the size of the one in Arizona, Meteor Crater. But they have ruled it out. It's going to miss. So it's going to pass a few thousand miles away. So no.
Now, why is it hitting exciting to us? What kind of
it would make a deep impact? It would throw a lot of ejected material up into the atmosphere. So we'd get to use all of our cool equipment we have on Mars right now, like the MRO, Mars Reconnaissance Observer, which has this great imaging system called HiRISE on it. And it would be able to look at that plume and see what material was ejected out. Right. So we'd get like this really big sample of what's below the crater, below the surface that was thrown out from the crater.
All right. Okay. Since we're doing space news, what's the other M planet?
Well, let me finish on Mars. Just a quick, the two rovers still working.
They could do something.
Moving into their fifth year. So this, you know, they've definitely passed their 90-day warranty. So good job, JPL. You built some cool stuff.
No, but kudos. Would those rovers, wouldn't it hurt the rovers if a bloom of dust came up? It would cover up their...
If they were in the area, sure, yeah. The chances of them being in the right place at the wrong time, or the wrong place at the right time, no, very insignificant. We probably wouldn't be able to use the rovers for science.
For an impact. Sorry. But impact's not going to happen.
But impact's not going to happen, so it's all moot at this point.
Well, what is going to happen?
The other cool flyby that's going to happen on Monday is the Messenger spacecraft is going to fly by Mercury. Mercury we haven't been to for a long time since the Pioneer 10 spacecraft did a flyby. Oh, gosh, when was that? Back in the 70s. So we're going to go by, and this is the first of three flybys before they actually insert the Messenger spacecraft into orbit around Mercury, and then it's going to do some science.
So we're going to learn a lot about Mercury.
Yeah, they're hoping it's going to last for a year. It's pretty close to the sun. You know, it's not like it's going to melt or anything, but it does get more radiation, and they're going to do some studies, and they're going to
figure out the atmosphere. They're going to take like 1,000 photos of it.
Right, we're going to see a hemisphere of Mercury that we have never seen. When Mariner 10 flew by in 1975, it did some imaging of it, but it was just passing by, so it just took what it could see. With the best technology of 1975. Now we're going to actually park this in orbit around it. So the first flyby, we're going to get some images of a hemisphere we've never seen. We're going to get some images of the Caloris crater, the largest crater in the solar system. So we're going to be able to see some cool stuff from that.
From what I understand, that crater and Mercury is a little strange in that it's probably Mercury because of its giant iron core was formed farther out in that. Around where Mars is, and at some point it got pushed into the inner system, and that crater might be the impact that caused that.
That's one theory, yeah.
Very similar to how we got our moon. In fact, Mercury and our moon are relatively close in size to each other.
Anyway,
I'm looking forward to the pictures. I guess it's going to happen Monday or Tuesday. I can't remember.
Monday is the flyby. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the 14th.
All right, well, thank you, John, for the update on space news. Sean, news?
Yeah, this might be the last Blu-ray news story.
The last
ever?
One?
Why? Yeah. I don't know. Everyone's falling like a stack of cards.
Blu-ray one?
Blu-ray seems to be winning really quickly.
What do you mean the last HD store?
Well, Warner Brothers, we talked about last week, dropped HD DVD and said they're going Blu-ray. Yeah, and they didn't have any reason to do this because they're driven by the snap quick, I'm going to buy a disc.
Right.
Going to a store, people just buy these things. The problem is that with rising gas prices, falling DVD sales, deteriorating U.S. economy, they felt that people just aren't making these snap decisions to buy high definition discs because they just don't know which format to back. Not everyone's bought these players yet, so they felt that they needed to expedite the end of the war before the economy worsens.
Mm-hmm.
And they made the decision that Blu-ray seems to be winning. Blockbuster was backing them. A bunch of other people are already backing them.
Every story we have seems to be Blu-ray winning.
So Warner Brothers, they went Blu-ray, and now HBO has announced that they're going exclusively
with
Blu-ray.
Sean, would you say this is the nail in the coffin for HD?
All I wanted was Band of Brothers on HD, and I didn't like the fact it was on HD DVD, because then I'd have to get a player that plays both, which I did. But it seems to be, Blu-ray.
Since it
hasn't come out yet, and they have Deadwood and From Earth to the Moon, a bunch of big... Angels in America, a bunch of big titles I think people want on HD are probably going to come out on Blu-ray now. So
it's funny when you say,
I think this is
it. It's so clear to you when you say they wanted HD, you mean high definition, not the HD DVD format.
Yeah, so not to confuse anybody, Blu-ray and HD DVD are both high definition formats. HD formats. Mm-hmm. So that is confusing. So with HD DVD going away, I guess that won't be as confusing.
Sean, do you have any preference? On either Blu-ray or HD?
Yeah, I like Blu-ray. But, you know, I like to record my data to Blu-ray as a backup to, you know, as a way to backup data. And, you know, 30 gigs versus 50 gigs to me is very compelling. I'd rather have the 50 gig Blu-ray potential of their dual layer discs.
Now, and John, my preference is Blu-ray as well because of the science behind it. You know, HDVD is using the same frequency of light as traditional DVD players, the red frequency, red range.
Whereas Blu-ray is
Blu-ray
higher frequency.
Blue, and therefore, technically, Blu-ray should be able to always do more data on the same size of media. So Blu-ray is just technically a superior.
That's kind of how I feel too, is HD DVD is kind of the end of that technology. Yeah. We've pushed this to this point. Isn't this awesome? But Blu-ray is starting a new technology from that point. I agree.
And HD DVD continues the same manufacturing process that CDs and DVDs used, and there's a lot of bad things for the environment in that those discs. Blu-ray is actually greener. it is a greener-based technology. Yeah. So I like that aspect too.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that. Well, let's go back to CES and say what happened else. What other things do you see on the floor, Peter, that that piqued your interest?
A few more things with the displays. Aside from the...
Okay, one more thing about the display, and then after that we're going to go on other things. But go for it. What's the next display one?
Hey, there might be a lot of cool stuff.
Yeah, displays. Actually, there are a lot of cool things. I've got two.
This is the age of visual computing.
All right, displays it is. Go for it.
It's all display-centric. So aside from the 150-inch displays, two companies, Sony and... Gee, I forget the second, were showing quad HD displays. So
what?
Think quad? 1080p times 4.
Oh, my. Wow.
How big a screen?
100 inches plus.
Wow.
And so they were all showing basically static content taken with still cameras, you know, maybe panning around. And that was stunning. That was beautiful.
Can you really tell the difference between quad HD and HD?
Yeah.
How do you put the data on? Where's the data come from? And that's a lot of content. I mean,
you need a couple
files.
Dual link DVI connectors.
At least, right?
Yeah.
You need a couple dual link.
Yeah, you can do HD
twice.
With single link.
So DVI is the digital display connection.
Yeah, digital visual interface.
Dual link is twice the amount of data.
Right.
30-inch flat panels today need a single dual link connection.
Yeah.
Or not flat, LCDs. So 30-inch LCD is a really big one.
2560 by 1600, and this is, what, 4K by 2K?
That is a lot of pixels, and that's one screen.
One screen. It's one piece of LCD glass.
So,
and the only seam I could see was they had to use two polarizing filters, so there was a little bit of a blurry line down the middle.
Because they couldn't get a polarizing filter that big.
Yeah.
That makes sense. All right, so...
And the second...
What would you use that for?
Showing
slideshows of really high-quality images?
That and...
Six-megapixel camera can't do that. Can't make a picture that good. So...
No, but there are cameras that can.
Yeah, 12-megapixel could do it, I guess.
You know, we'll also see full 1080p HD camcorders this year.
And, of course, that would be a great setup for multiple viewing content where you've got a wall
Definitely.
Display.
That was one of the formats that they showed was four 1080p channels.
So when are they going to make 1080p part of the standard? Any talk about that?
Broadcast? It's 1080p 30 as part of the broadcast standard. I don't know if any of the equipment does it. There are like 37 different formats in ATSC.
Wow.
When you count all the timing variations. The other cool display thing was NEC was showing a DLP-based widescreen 4K by 900 pixel wide wraparound monitor.
Wraparound?
How wraparound? How round
it
was
needs,
it?
They weren't talking about it publicly, but you could see the edge blending scenes. They were using four rear projection DLP units inside like a 21-inch high.
How wide?
42-degree wraparound.
Okay,
so it's
more than 45-degree, about 45-degree sides. So basically you're talking about a round display that circles you.
With one seamless image.
Wow.
With one DVI connection, so it needs DVI dual link. But that means you have a great field of view for VizSim applications, flight simulators.
Museums would love this sort of
thing. Oh, yeah. Well, museums are going to be one of the few groups that can afford it. It's 5K.
I don't think museums can afford 5K.
And some of them can.
$5,000 for a 20-inch by
40-inch, something like that.
Display that wraps around you.
It's targeted at the professional market, but they will be shipping it this year.
That's a deal of a third the price, you know?
Yeah.
Well, that's a pretty great display. I mean, I use two displays at work. And of course, it's a 20-inch and like a 17-inch display. And I love having that kind of real estate. Imagine having it no seams. You can move it anywhere you want. It would totally change your computing experience.
We're going to have to come up with a new way for measuring these screens. Because you do that diagonally.
Yeah, yeah, so what is that diagonal? diagonally curved or not?
That's actually an issue. When you start to get multiple screens for VisSim applications and even games, you need to set up the virtual cameras in the application to make sure that they match the configuration of the displays.
That's true. Well, and the other question I have for this is normally if you're doing a 3D game, you've got two monitors, you're going to go to one game when you're doing like an SLI format game.
Yeah, one monitor.
One monitor, yeah. Rather. Yeah. So how would something like this work? It would still just choose one of these zones, correct? Or would you be able to use the continental?
No, it's a single DVI connector.
It's a single DVI connector, so it appears so that, as one monitor.
Just like a 30-inch LCD.
Yeah. But the application...
The hardware is doing all the work,
right?
The scaling work.
But since it's curved, it would be wrong. I mean, it would be... Your eye would be
You're
like,
going to have to figure out how to configure the application for that perspective.
Yeah.
And that's something... that information is not embedded in the EDID, so the industry needs to find a way, come up with a way...
There needs to be some data coming back from the monitor.
There's a proposal for next generation EDID.
What's EDID?
Is that the format
of communication between the monitor and the computer?
It's the one-way format of communication so the monitor can report its identity, its serial number, its resolution, its formats.
How your computer identifies the monitor.
Right, all right. So the monitor can send EDID information back to the computer.
And it's very small. It's two 128-byte chunks.
So this is such a new technology of curved screens. There's no information about what the format of sending saying.
There's
I'm
not
this
room in that 256 byte tag.
Well, thank you, Peter, on the display information. Let's go on to one more news story from John, and we'll open up the calls and also talk more about CES content. John, news story.
I just had two quick environmental ones. One is it snowed yesterday in Baghdad.
Isn't that a little rare?
The first time in last century, the first time in living memory. It didn't actually hit the ground. Well, it didn't stick to the ground. It just, because the ground is too hot.
Mm-hmm.
There hasn't been freezing temperatures long enough to freeze the ground and have it stick. But it got down to 0 centigrade, and it snowed.
Very cool.
Also in environmental news, we have a new possibility for cellular-based ethanol. Looking for the catchphrase for that. I'll find it here in a moment. But it's called switchgrass, which normally just grows naturally, borders the crops in Kansas, Nebraska, places like that. It's got a much higher energy yield than corn-based ethanol. It's about 21 and a half times as efficient as corn-based ethanol. So they estimate that an acre of it would give you 13.1 megajoules of energy. So that's 21 times more efficient than corn-based ethanol. The only problem with it, and the other option is using like a sawdust-based, taking all the extra sawdust from lumber industry and turning it into a cell-based ethanol. Cellulostic, that's the word, cellulostic ethanol. The only problem with this is it requires much more intensive refining processes to extract the energy from that and turn it into a burnable form. So there is an initial load up front of investing and developing this mm-hmm. this new way of creating the energy, pulling the energy
and
out
making
of
it small enough for the gas stations.
Well, it would be refined elsewhere, but then stored like normal ethanol. So it wouldn't impact the gas stations. It's just the refining techniques need to be refined.
but I like the idea of the gas stations refining their own, or I guess that's what's really cool about the other potential next generation technologies. Nitrogen, so on like that.
Compressed air.
You know, that they can do it themselves and you don't have these big gas trucks moving the fuel and wasting gas.
It wouldn't work so much with ethanol because the refinery you need isn't compact enough to...
Yeah.
It doesn't really make
sense. No, it's not going to work. See, that's just why I think we should get away from those kind of...
gas station next to a giant field of grass.
It's not going to work.
How many gallons you need? Hold on,
ethanol.
Let me get my mower.
Yeah, no.
It's not going to work with gas.
The smaller the plant... You lose all of the efficiencies you could get from large scale production.
So
economies of scale.
John, what's wrong in your mind about the corn based ethanol?
The energy produced, it's almost a net. There's almost a net loss of energy produced from corn based ethanol. With the harvesting, the growing, the energy that goes into the growing, the harvesting of it, the refining of it, the transportation of it, it's almost a net loss. So you needed something that produced more energy per acre, and the switchgrass seems to be a good way to do that. You've also got the whole controversy with you're using food as a fuel source. So you're making food more expensive by doing this. And corn is in everything. Corn syrup, you know, mm-hmm. the high fructose corn syrup is in almost everything. So anything that contains that is going to be a little bit more expensive, all corn-based.
Yeah, I think corn has doubled in cost over the last 4 years.
Wow. Speaking of, well, this is kind of a stretch, but you introduced this segment as alternative fuels, mm-hmm. or actually you said, I'm not going to be able to make the connection. I just want to say that next week's show, we're going to be talking with Josh, who used to be here at the station with us, Josh Weiss, about his Partners in Solidarity project that he's been working in Guatemala. And it's about using technology that we are throwing away, basically recycled technology, and putting it into practice, older computers. And so reuse will be our theme for next week and how the digital divide is being shortened or made smaller. So that's what next week's show will be. Today we are talking with Peter Sheeran, who spent the whole week at CES about Consumer Electronics Show. We also have John Tracy and Sean Cleveland, and we're going to be taking your calls. So I'll give that information in just a second. GeekSpeak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez. Excuse me. GeekSpeak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation, and offering one appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. You are listening to GeekSpeak. We are now taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. New technology. The numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You can, of course, use the internet. Go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. Stay with KOSP for Castle Cottage this morning at 11 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio KOSP. You're listening to GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. The geeks this morning are Sean Cleveland, John Tracy, and our special guest, Peter Sheeran. We are now taking your calls with questions and comments of technology, and we will continue our discussion about CES. GeekSpeak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley, offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, Notary Public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. All right. Peter, next up in CES was another fun thing. We'll move away from the displays, though I agree they're fascinating. I definitely like the curved one.
That's basically all I have in displays.
Yeah, okay.
Lucky.
All right, good. What else, though? There was a few more things there.
Lots of GPS devices, lots of GPS navigation devices. Over the past year, I've seen, maybe a couple of years, a lot of people talking about doing this on the cell phones, but that's not what I saw at CES. It was all car dash mount mm-hmm. GPS devices.
And car mount GPS systems was a big seller this year.
For
the end of the year.
It was one of the big three categories that boosted like Best Buy this year.
Mm-hmm. So what do you see that was new and unique in the GPS area?
Couple interesting things. Two-way GPS. So
what?
Two-way. Two-way.
How's that work?
What is that? What
so
mean?
I have two different companies that were doing interesting things. One is a new company called GPS Buddy. They hook up a GPS cell phone transceiver, put it in a cigar lighter plug, and connect it to a Garmin GPS.
Okay.
Any Garmin GPS made in the last, 4 or 5 years, they've been secretly working with Garmin to put their two-way software in the Garmin units.
So what is the two-way? You're going to tell the satellites?
You can do vehicle tracking. So it's targeted mostly at the commercial market, fleets. So the device is $319 and the service is $30 a month.
And you know where all your cars
are. Yeah, so your dispatcher gets a web client. They can find out where all of the people are, where all the vehicles are.
Yeah.
Help them find their next destination if it's not in the GPS. And they can send them text messages. And the guy with the GPS can type on the touch screen and send messages back.
Oh, that's pretty cool. So this is basically so that the dispatcher knows where all the fleet vehicles are. And now this kind of – has this technology been around? This is just kind of a cheaper, a less expensive implementation and works with
standard
GPS.
It's been around in a custom format. You know, you had to buy a couple hundred, $500 piece of hardware that you had to sign up with a large company that had this nationwide infrastructure. And they're using, leftover – there are companies that resell unused spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
In the cell phone networks. They take advantage of that. They link their hardware with the Garmin units and sell it for cheap.
Yeah. I mean, that's under $500 kind of range. That's almost cheap enough to do couples and, friends that want to know where they are.
Yeah, or family with a couple kids driving.
Yeah, know where your kids are all the time. Uh-huh. Are there portable ones you can actually insert into the body yet, or is that still a ways away?
You mean a GPS chip inserted under the skin?
Sure, yeah. I want to know where my kids are.
Yeah, that'll be a while,
okay.
I think.
What was the other GPS news?
Okay, so...
That's fantastic that it's so inexpensive. I would assume that pretty much any fleet company would start adding that kind of feature.
Yeah.
My son really likes to go to the Santa Cruz Sheriff officers and get stickers that they hand out to kids. It's a little fun. And then my kids kind of get comfortable with kids with police officers. So the sheriffs in Santa Cruz now have systems like that in their cars. They've got full laptops running Windows, actually. And information can be sent back and forth via cell phone. And they're getting even mug shots being sent to them. And, of course, they don't have to call in or dispatch a checking a license plate. They can just do it on their own.
Right, so. They're doing it in the back seat, though, right?
No, they're doing it in the front seat. Yeah.
That's against the law.
I know, but who's going to enforce it in a sheriff's car?
Yeah, well, the police seem to do a lot of stuff that is skirting the motor vehicle code.
Yeah, yeah.
So the other one is a lot more consumer oriented.
You know. I know, they have guns in their cars. Sorry, go on.
So the other company is Dash, and this is two-way GPS for consumers.
Oh, it is?
It's a dash-mounted GPS navigation device, and they're using two-way communications with Wi-Fi and, again, the cell phone network to do real-time links. So forget that point of interest POI database that's 6 months out of date because you only get it once a year, or probably 18 months out of date because
you take your
the
car
data collection.
Tuned or something.
So you go looking for something that's new and it's not in the database, or you look in the database and the place is closed. They're using the two-way link to do these updates in real time, and they have far more, like 10 million POI points.
Are they also doing traffic, like real-time traffic?
Yes.
Yeah, nice.
So really they're using the reports from the Dash units to create this cloud of information. And they're also using additional data sources. So most of the existing, like the TMC traffic receivers, are just getting the major highways.
Mm-hmm.
They're also getting the major arterials, so the side streets, you know, so 101 and El Camino Real.
Right. Well, because the information is delivered specific to each user.
Yes, but they also have other data sources that are not coming from their deployed GPS units that they're capturing from these side roads. So, you know, well, not the side roads, but the major arterials outside of the highways.
So, Sean, how do you update your Prius's GPS library?
I guess when I take it in for a service.
Does it feel like it gets updated, or you just feel like you're kind of...
No, I don't see any difference.
I think there's
4 years
update
ago,
with the
there
DVD.
Was a Starbucks
you
over
know
there.
What? My parents live in a housing community out by Modesto that is off the map.
It's still off
so,
the map.
So, yeah, and it hasn't been updated, at least with their information. So
yeah.
I haven't seen it.
So you might have to request it specifically.
Maybe I will next time I go in. Yeah. You know, Dash is getting a lot of word of mouth lately. I've been hearing a lot about them.
They're the ones that did the big selling.
So they must actually have units out there that people are using. Do you know that?
I think they're shipping in the first quarter. They're probably seeding prototypes now.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So they're a new company.
It's not their hardware. They took off-the-shelf hardware, had it built to their specs. So their specialty is the firmware.
And the service.
The service.
Sure.
You can also do real-time Yahoo searches right on
through
the GPS.
Through the touch screen on the GPS.
Yes.
That's pretty nice. All right. Thank you very much for that. One of you, Sean or John, you guys want to do the news story?
You know.
Go for it, John. Sean, sorry.
There was a story on Slashdot about California Energy Commission looking at ways to control thermostats in private homes. So when rolling blackouts happen, they could actually send some sort of a radio message to your thermostat to raise the temperature.
Oh, to heat up your house before you're going to go down?
Well, no, so you don't have any air conditioning units turn off or
for
whatever.
Cooling,
Or for heating. I guess for anything, they can control the thermostat to make sure that you're not using power when they need it most.
This general idea is smart electrical grid, and it's become kind of a big issue in that if we were able to manage our electrical grid in a more intelligent way, things like, okay, my washing machine is ready to go. I need it to run in the next 4 hours. And then the grid would decide, hey, let's turn on that person's washing machine. When that's done, we'll turn on the next person's washing machine.
So all this was shown at CES.
Yeah.
I don't know how I feel about that, especially with, you know, there's reports that some kid took over a tram system with a remote control. Right. Another person was walking through the CES show with a clicker that he made from make.com, you know, Make magazine.
This is the Gizmo website, Gizmodo website.
Yeah, Gizmodo, and he was turning off displays during presentations.
That's
okay,
just mean.
That's just wrong. But video wall, turning off displays, that's kind of funny. But when he actually sat on a presentation, the guy up there is getting flustered because his display went away. And this company is spending how much money to put this guy up there and to gather all the press people that are there?
That's sabotage.
Gaffer's tape.
That sounds like a lawsuit to me.
That's right. Cover up the IR sensor with some gaffer's tape. That's right, Peter. It's a nice, simple, low-tech solution.
It's funny, though, that no one ever checked the monitor to see if it was off or not. And there was still audio coming from the presentation. They just kind of sat there and looked at it and went,
Yeah, and Gizmodo's perspective is that people take a CES too seriously. That was their idea. I think that's it's a major show. Of course they take it seriously.
A lot of people take money
industry.
Very seriously.
You know, I have a different perspective here.
What's your perspective?
I get so tired of this technology not working right because the designers of the tools, the engineers, the product managers, haven't done their homework, haven't thought about all the things that can happen, haven't thought about people bluejacking and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Because all this technology is in one place, it's a great test bed. And it should be torture tested there.
Okay. I get that. But on most of these displays, they're consumer products. Why would a consumer want to be able to cover up their IR thing? You'd have to have the manufacturer...
To stop the sun from turning the television off or stray IR signals.
But that's so rare. You got a Coke can, you spin it in the sunlight, and you get the pattern right, and the thing goes off. I mean, that's pretty rare. I mean, I get what you're saying, but how would you solve that problem with IRs being on sometimes but not on some other times?
Pair the remote control.
But then, okay, so you buy a TV, you want to pair the remote control. Then you, if you want to get a smart remote control, you got to get the code into that
remote control. Not necessarily.
Oh, you mean like a Bluetooth pairing kind of thing?
Yeah.
That's a good idea. All right, so why aren't you working on that? So you're saying is somebody going along and turning off these TVs is going to make the next manufacturer go, you know what, we're going to solve this problem and improve it.
Perhaps.
Well, I like that perspective. I hadn't thought of that perspective. Thank you very much, Peter. All right, you're up for the next news story.
News story.
Well, let's talk CES. CES. Well, what else did you see?
CES is news.
Okay, well, let me segue from that home automation thing. There was a lot of home automation stuff there. Some security, some automation, and we have another standards battle brewing, just like HD DVD versus Blu-ray.
Uh-oh.
There are two big camps. There's Zigbee and Z-Wave.
Okay. And what's the difference between them?
They're both wireless. They're both roughly in the 900 megahertz band. Zigbee is actually based on an IEEE standard, 802.15.4, and it's designed for large mesh networks of automation, factory floor automation, home automation, all sorts of stuff like that. Z-Wave is also wireless, also mesh network, but it's a proprietary protocol.
Can I guess which one you're supporting?
I haven't figured out yet because one of the biggest groups being a proponent of Zigbee is Control 4, and they have their own proprietary extension. So if you go to the Control 4 people, they'll tell you that Z-Wave is proprietary. And if you go to Z-Wave, they'll tell you that the Control 4 stuff is proprietary. So there hasn't been a lot of interoperability here, and I don't think there's going to be for a while. So all these cool things you were talking about before of the power company being able to send commands to your devices in your home, which standard?
Right.
And there are a whole bunch of proprietary things because people that do high-end home installations get frustrated with this stuff not working, and they put all their own stuff together.
Can we look at past multiple format solutions to communications and see what came out of that and then apply that kind of idea to what this is and kind of make an assessment of what will happen? I mean, for example, hard drives. I'm sure there were multiple formats of hard drive interfaces and slowly the people grouped together. So are we going to see one of these come out and will it be the IEEE sanctioned one, do you think?
I hope so, but I don't have high hopes because, I mean, even with hard drive interfaces, look, we still have eSATA for stuff outside the box. We still have eSATA, USB, FireWire.
Right. So it'd be like the USB FireWire situation.
Yeah.
Both of them exist and both can improve.
All right. I think that's having multiple standards here will hurt the whole industry and hurt the homeowners.
I think the home automation push of better conservation of energy, you know, sensors in the rooms that turn off the lights, things that you... that the system pays itself back for you, you know, in 6 months or in a year and a half with what it conserves. Like the idea of saying, you know, I want to run all my appliances that need to only run once a day. I only want to run them during the cheap hours at night for the grid. Things like that actually affect the consumer and is more than just being, having the convenience of home automation.
Yeah, I think the only way we'll get past the standards fighting amongst each other is for maybe a government agency like the EPA to mandate a solution that will let us get the best power savings.
Yeah, power savings seems like the good push for that. Do you have any home automation in your place?
A little bit of X10 stuff.
Yeah, I have some X10 stuff too.
And it's frustrating that that's the biggest standard around because it's unreliable.
Yeah.
It's slow. It can take a second to send commands.
Not so great for turning on a light?
No. No.
Yeah.
And it's very insecure. There aren't that many house codes, so if you've got neighbors and it's difficult for the signals to get across some of the connections in homes.
Yeah. So X10, Z-Wave, Control 4, and also Zigbee. Who's using Zigbee, which is the IEEE? Is there a big company that's doing that?
GE actually has some stuff.
Yeah. So GE's choosing an IEEE format for their...
I'm sorry. No, Zigbee chose Z-Wave.
GE chose Z-Wave. So that's the thing that starts doing... Yeah, okay. Because GE makes all the appliances. You're not going to go find... You're not going to buy a different appliance based on
the home
resolution
protocol. Yeah, and I don't
know
if GE is doing this in appliances yet, but there's... I think it's a company that licensed the GE name for home automation stuff, like controllers, stuff like that, remote controls.
But what about like the washing machine having smarts in it that actually interact with something? How is that going in the refrigerator and stuff? Are those protocols being open? You know, are those a standard yet, or are they all just all over the map?
You know, I haven't seen the home automation companies talk about that. There was a double wide trailer in the parking lot across from CES that was really mostly an ad for some of the high end home automation companies where, they had the oven in the kitchen connected to a interface that works through Windows Media Center. So it can tell you that the roast is done.
In the living room.
Right. Or on your Windows Media Center remote control.
Not so compelling. Maybe it is, but...
But these were all proprietary solutions, so they're not using Zigbee or Z-Wave.
Let's say you've got a remote cabin in the woods somewhere, and that you go visit, like, you know, hey, we're going to go up and do a ski weekend. And you don't want to get there and have the place, you know, freezing cold. And
sure. Yeah, it'd be cool to just kick all that off. Yeah.
We have an uncle who has this. He calls up, and he dials in a number, and it turns on the heat, it turns on the light, it starts a bunch of things, gets a water heater going, things like that. So by the time he gets up there, the cabin's warm, it's lit, the hot water's ready to go.
That's pretty nice.
Yeah.
I wish I had a cabin in the woods like that. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. That was John Tracy. Peter Sheeran is our guest, and we also have Sean Cleveland. We're talking about the Consumer Electronics Show. We are taking calls, and we have somebody waiting, I guess. I haven't been paying attention to that. Sorry about that, but let's go ahead and take the call if we can.
Line one, Uncle Dennis.
Uncle Dennis. I wasn't upsetting Uncle Dennis. Uncle Dennis, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi, geeks. How are you doing today?
Quite well.
Good.
I called in to thank the geeks for a really great suggestion. If you recall, I was trying to set up a network-attached storage box, and I had gotten myself into a kind of a fluster trying to get permissions and things like that worked out so that I could actually copy files back and forth. And you suggested that I try FreeNAS, and we did that, and an hour later we were up and running, and I really appreciate the suggestion.
Oh, great.
So, Free Radio thanks you, and Uncle Dennis thanks you.
Well, thanks, Uncle Dennis, for calling up KSP.
It's great.
That's awesome.
All right.
Drew's going to be happy to hear that.
Definitely.
Yeah.
All right.
So was it hard to set up?
No, it was
pretty easy, huh?
It was really easy. The hardest part was figuring out how to burn the image on the CD.
So what we're talking about is FreeNAS is a Linux distribution that is a network-attached storage solution. So you get a computer with a whole bunch of hard drives in it, and then you download this ISO image, and you install it on that computer. Burning to CD is kind of difficult. It's true. And then once you have it up and running, it's got all the permissions protocols, and basically it's complete package of software that allows you to
need very
storage.
You know, the hardware requirements are probably pretty low for something like this.
Yeah, we basically had a Pentium 3 1 gig processor, 256 megabytes of RAM, and a network card and a couple of hard drives. And it came up and ran, and it was pretty darn easy to configure. It's configured through a web page that you access over the LAN.
Right.
And
that's brilliant.
The documentation is pretty straightforward. The implementation, you know, the screens look great. And
this is basically a way of using older hardware to use it for archiving and backups and data access. Pretty great thing to have as a network-attached storage. I love mine. I'm using a ReadyNAS box, but this is a great alternative if you've got an old computer.
Let's use this as a segue to back to Peter. I want to
thank you, excuse me. Thank you, Uncle Dennis, very much for the call. Bye-bye.
Thank you, geeks. Bye.
So I want to know, did you see anything about storage there at CES, or is that just too computer-focused for such a gadget show?
No, there was. It was scattered. There were a handful of companies showing NAS stuff.
And they're all, you buy the unit, and it's got everything you need.
Yeah.
Yeah. And no one was coming up with new backup technologies?
Not that I saw.
That's too bad.
Actually, the coolest storage thing I saw was kind of a mashup. HP is selling USB flash drives. And they've got a new one that's going to be shipping first quarter. $100, 16 gigabytes, and it comes with a sync utility on it that will sync your email, Outlook Express, 7 days worth of email, and you can pay for an upgrade to the pro version that lets you upgrade on, you know, a month or whatever. And it's plug and play. You plug it into a computer, it pops up its utility, and you can synchronize, you know, my documents folder.
So this is a perfect solution if you've got like two computers and you're traveling.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like a work computer and a home computer.
And
yeah.
Everything stays in the flash drive. Any temporary stuff that's left on the hard drive gets deleted when you pull it out.
Oh, so you can even go to a friend's computer and plug this in and
go to library. Yeah. Whatever.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a nice feature. I like that. And 16 gigabytes for $100, it's nice just for
standard. Well, 120, but yeah, it'll hit $100 soon.
That's pretty good. Okay, well, I know, I mean, there's, you know, 20,000 products at the show, and you were the one that went, so I'm really trying to get, like, what you liked. So please, next thing that you thought was interesting at the show.
Let's see. Let me go back to the power stuff. One of the coolest standalone gadgets I found, let's see if I can find it in my notes. Here. Found this in the International Hall, which is usually a bunch of, well, junk. But you find a few gems spread throughout. Uh-huh. And I think this was a Taiwanese company, maybe Hong Kong. It's called CheckTap. It's a USB power strip.
What is it? What's the USB for?
Controlling the outlets, turning them on and off. So there's one port that you plug your computer into that is always on. And the other five or six can be turned off according to power saving features. So forget all these devices that have sleep modes that still use too much power.
Mm-hmm.
After 20 minutes of idle, you put your computer to sleep, this program sends a command over the USB port to turn off all the other...
We've talked about this a few shows ago.
Because the transformer bricks actually draw power when the device is off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
it's a good amount of leakage, and you add that up, and it's a major problem.
Yeah.
So this is the simple solution of any peripherals, like even a desk lamp could be plugged into this, right? And the computer, when it goes to sleep, your office kind of shuts down.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and you put your hand back on the mouse, your computer wakes up, the software notices that the computer is awake, and it turns on all the AC ports again.
All right. Well, how would this be for, like, powering an external USB drive? Like, wouldn't that be, you kind of want to wake that up before the computer woke up?
Not necessarily.
I'm sure it's configurable, though.
It's plug and play.
I'm sure it's configurable where you can put it in, like, a start sequence or
maybe
a time.
You know, the version that they had at the show, it's all or nothing.
Mm-hmm.
All the other five ports are on or off. But they were telling me about a new one that they didn't get in time to get to the show that lets you control them individually.
Yeah.
So you could set up the... you know, maybe one of the ports to never turn off or only turn off if the computer's hibernating.
The thing is, this is crucial for us doing better power management.
Yeah.
I mean,
but it's a shame that you have to go to something like this when there is power saving built into these devices that doesn't work. It should work right to begin with.
So the power saving that doesn't work, we've talked about it before. Can you give me a description of what's the drain on your normal, like, power strip? What's being drained and wasted all the time?
You know, I haven't actually, and that's one of the other cool things that this thing does. Is the utility asks you to input the standby and running power for each of the devices plugged into it.
Ah.
So it will calculate how much power you're saving. I haven't done that with my home setup. I haven't calculated everything I have plugged in. And actually, you really should, because you shouldn't be overloading the outlets.
Right.
Maybe I've got too many amps in my power strip.
And of course, the simplest way to do this right now without buying new hardware is if you do have a power strip with your desk and stuff and you know what's plugged into it, when you do turn off your computer, turn that off as well. Because you power that off, then you're definitely getting all the power killed to those devices that have a drain. I mean, also, you know, go away for a day and come back into your home and when you haven't been using anything, and go around and feel the different power blocks, and they're warm. There's energy being wasted all the time.
Yeah, and, you know, it's been a number of years since I've seen this talked about, but there used to be a company with a technology called Tiny Plug. They had a computer chip that would be embedded in the wall wart and sense the power need.
And
so
and really
it would put
off.
It into a trickle.
Yeah.
Unless there was load applied, and I haven't seen anything about
this
in 6 years.
Yep. I'm telling you, that's all because power is too inexpensive in this country. Electricity is too inexpensive. If it cost more, we'd be conserving more.
Wasn't there a button for it's called the greenhouse button or something like that? And it was like you could wire your house to have it where this one button would turn off, you're leaving for the day or leaving for a week. You could push this button.
It turns off all the circuits except for the refrigerator or whatever you need to stay on all the time. Yeah, definitely. Well, we're coming pretty close to the end of the show, Peter. You got one more thing to tell us about, unfortunately. I wish, and maybe we'll have to just do another show because.
Okay, well, so I left a whole bunch of notes in the restaurant down the road that I have to go retrieve, so I have a lot more. Last thing then, you're familiar with the Four Dummies books?
Yes, Four Dummies.
They're building products now. What? So they're bundling, they're finding a product that is difficult to use, designing an easy to use version, and providing a book or a quick start guide in one package. They've done this.
The Four Dummies series is like networking for dummies, radio for dummies, that kind of thing.
So they've got about a dozen of these that'll be coming out this year. Digital camcorder for dummies, digital camera for dummies, cable satellite wiring kit, a network cabling kit, heart rate monitor, TV wall mounting kit, a telescope kit, a world phone, a GSM world phone, a GPS navigation device. They'll have a line of these. And home theater cables.
This could actually be a good thing.
I think so. Like home TV cables. Imagine, this cable goes here, this cable goes. You don't think, just read what we're telling
you to
do.
This is a great concept, but what a commentary that today's products are so difficult that they have to do this.
But see, the solution to this is buy the complicated stuff and give it to your 7-year-old. And they'll handle it for you.
This is idiocracy coming to me.
It is. We're making... What's your marketing push? We sell to dumb people.
Which is
cool.
Which is the your consumer market.
Not dumb people, just non-technical people.
I know, but that's the thing, is change the name, technically easy products. The dumb name is just dumb.
Yeah.
It's like saying someone who, like a doctor who can't figure out their VCR. He's not dumb.
I'm a dummy.
He's just invested his mental resources in something else.
And I guess that's kind of a good analogy. Like, I don't do home surgery.
Suit yourself, right?
Right, because it's a little difficult. But I guess home surgery for dummies, and maybe it would make me do that. Well, Peter, I really appreciate you coming on and talk about CES. Clearly, there's a lot more to talk about. We've got a show booked next week, but we don't for the following, so we'll have to have you back.
Talk
more about CES, Peter. I want to push your website. It's
Pete's Guide.
Pete's Guide. So Pete'sGuide.com. Of course, you can go to geekspeak.org and see a little bit of notes about today's show. This is GeekSpeak on KOSP. GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. The geeks this morning were John Tracy and Sean Cleveland. Peter Sheeran was our guest. You can read more about at his website, Pete'sGuide.com. Thank you for listening to GeekSpeak. And to those that called in, one person that called in, thanks for calling in. And for Rick Philman for answering the phones. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. Tune in for This American Life Sunday morning at 10 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Auto, broadcasting HD radio on 88.9 FM, or on the web at kosp.org. For next week's show, we're going to be talking about reusing computers in Guatemala, and it should be a wonderful show. We're going to have Josh Weiss on talking about how he's been helping people bridge the digital divide and kind of what happens, what you can do with your old computer and hardware. You can actually put it back in production. You just listened to another episode of GeekSpeak via our podcast. Would you do us a favor? Please go to your favorite podcasting index site, whether it be iTunes, Dig.com, Odeo, or another site, and write a review or give us a vote to let others know what you think about GeekSpeak. Thanks, that'd really help us out. GeekSpeak is supported by PreownedCar.com, PreownedCar.com, where anyone can post their vehicle for sale or browse to purchase a pre-owned car from other car owners. More information available at PreownedCar.com. This is Lyle Troxell for KUSP. Thanks for listening.